Darius, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we take the term stop and frisk for granted here, mm-hmm. but for our listeners who aren't in New York City, can you explain what a stop and frisk is?
Sure. When we say stop, we're really talking about a detention of somebody's liberty by the police, albeit briefer than an arrest, but it is a situation where a police officer or a group of police officers will detain somebody, briefly on the street, and oftentimes will search them, which is what a frisk is. And by frisk, we mean a pat down of the outside of somebody's clothing, as opposed to going inside of their clothing, which is commonly referred to as a search. But in either case, for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, we are talking about a seizure when somebody is stopped. In other words, their liberty is being taken away from them for a period of time. And then when they are frisked, we're talking about a search of their, outside of their clothing.
And is this for the purpose of looking for a gun that might hurt the officer or for contraband?
Well, that's a good question, because the police department here in New York says that the reason they do these stops and frisks is because they're looking for illegal weapons. But we know from, all the data we've seen over the past decade, really, that just isn't true. And the reason it's not true is because about 99.3% of the time, they find no gun. The other thing about it is that the vast majority of the stops that are done in New York City are on suspicion of nonviolent crimes, oftentimes quality of life crimes like trespassing, vandalism, drinking in public. So for the police department to say they're doing this because they're looking for weapons just isn't true.
Let me go back for one second. Mm-hmm. I'm walking down the street.
Yeah.
A cop sees me. Can he just search me because he feels like searching me? Or does there have to be some kind of, is there an objective standard?
Yes.
What is the standard?
Well, according to the United States Supreme Court, in a case that they decided about 44 years ago called Terry versus Ohio, for a police officer to stop somebody on the street, they have to have what's called reasonable articulable suspicion. What that means is kind of hard to say. We know it's a lower standard than, what most people know as probable cause, but it has to be more than just a hunch or a whim or a, subjective belief that somebody's doing something wrong. There has to be, articulable, specific facts that the officer is aware of that would cause him or her to reasonably believe that this person has committed a crime, is in the process of committing a crime, or is about to commit a crime.
And this is true throughout the United States.
Yes.
That's the same standard.
Yes.
Now, I know that New York and maybe some other states as well have special training tapes that teach cops how to do what's reasonable suspicion is, I guess, the term. And I remember looking at an article, you probably can help us with this, but if I'm walking past a bunch of cars and I sort of, quote, furtively look into a car and a cop's watching me, I think in my case, because I'm sort of a white old guy, right, looking around, that furtive look, he's probably not going to stop me for that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's conceivable that if I'm Latino or black or young or some other category, he might stop me for that. So
yes.
Give me some sense of what that's about, furtive looking into a car or something. I mean, is that really a basis for stopping somebody?
Well,
isn't it then really based on my appearance more than anything?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, the federal courts that have dealt with this issue over the years, they've not really set clear-cut standards, but I think there seems to be a consensus that a furtive movement alone, some kind of quick movement, somebody looked in a car, somebody put something in their pocket, that by itself is not enough of a basis for an officer to believe, reasonably suspect someone for a crime. The reason it gets complicated, of course, is because officers will say, well, it wasn't just that they were moving, suspiciously, it was also because, this kid had a puffy jacket on, or he was in a neighborhood that we know there have been a lot of, car break-ins. So that's when it starts to get fuzzy, and that's where I think, there's room for abuse by officers and for their biases to come into the calculation.
Okay, so I'm walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
The cop has to have reasonable suspicion. Of course, that's, as you said, it's very hard to articulate, and they probably use all kinds of bad factors. Oh, he approaches me on the street, and he comes up to me. What does he say to me, and what rights do I have?
Well, I can tell you what your rights are under the law, and then I can tell you, the reality on the street, which, I think is important for people to think about so they stay safe. Well, if an officer stops a person and asks them, and they actually have reasonable suspicion, which of course the person can't know at the time, the person is not free to leave. In other words, they can't just ignore the officer and walk away. If they do, that gives the officer grounds to then even take it a step further and possibly arrest the person. But let's assume for the moment that they did have reasonable suspicion. If they didn't, the person could ignore the officer, and that's not supposed to give the officer a reason to then detain you. But if they have reasonable suspicion and they stop to ask you questions, you're supposed to answer the questions. Now, they may ask you for identification. If you don't have identification, that's not against the law in New York State, so you know you don't have to provide it to them. That
it may be against the law in some states, so we want to warn people.
Yes.
New
but,
York, you don't have to provide identification.
Yes. For them to then, so they can ask you questions, you know, which you know you're free to not answer, but you know, depending on what the questions are, if you don't answer them, that may give the officer a basis, you know, to have probable cause to arrest you. But assuming you're just having a conversation, you answer the questions, you know, where are you going, what are you doing, that kind of thing. For the officer to then take it to the next step and actually put his or her hands on you, they have to have reasonable suspicion that you're armed and dangerous. It can't just be that, oh, they think you might have drugs in your pocket or you might have a stolen something in your pocket. They actually have to fear for their safety. They have to have a reasonable belief that you might have a weapon or that you, you know, could commit an act of violence against them. Other than that, the only way they can put their hands on you is if you consent to it. So, you know, there have been situations we've been aware of where officers may ask a person, is it okay if I look in your bag? Is it okay if I, you know, pat you down? And you have a right to say no to that. And that, once you say no, the officer can't search you or even frisk you unless they have that reasonable, articulable suspicion. The law also says you can ask the officer why they're stopping you. They're supposed to tell you. You can ask the officer for their name and badge number if you want to file a complaint against them at a later point. Those are all your rights under the law as the laws are written. But, of course, the reality on the street is that officers don't comply with the law a lot of times. And they also oftentimes get angry or irritated if you assert the rights that you have. And so what commonly happens here in New York and I think in other places is if somebody does kind of assert their rights, the officer may retaliate against them by, you know, issuing them a ticket for disorderly conduct or, you know, placing them under arrest for disorderly conduct. And of course, disorderly conduct means whatever an officer wants it to mean. You know, you're causing trouble, you're being uppity or something like that. So, you know, there's definitely a difference between what happens on the street and what your rights are. But I think what we tell people is the most important thing is to get through the encounter safely and to be able to then go on with your life. So, you know, answering questions, you know, I think it's okay to say I don't consent to a search, and it's obviously okay to ask for these things like a badge number and a name, but if you're sensing that an officer is not appreciating your behavior, is getting irritated, is starting to escalate the situation, we recommend people just, you know, be quiet and try to get through it as quickly as possible.
I have a question about plainclothes officers. Mm-hmm. In your experience, are there statistics showing, I assume most of these stop and frisks are uniformed officers, but are there plainclothes as well, and wouldn't that change the dynamic between the individual stopped?
Those are good questions. Actually, you know, from what our look at the data, I can't say a majority of the stops are by plainclothes, but there are a large number of stops by officers in what are called anti-crime units, which are plainclothes units that drive around in unmarked cars. So there are a lot of stops by plainclothes officers. And, you know, in those situations, again, if an officer, once they actually interact with a person, they stop them, they're supposed to identify themselves as a police officer. They're supposed to, you know, pull their badge out of their shirt and show it to people, which they, again, do not always do. You know, we have talked to folks who've said in those situations when they've asked the person, because they didn't believe the person was a police officer, show me your badge, that officers oftentimes react angrily to that. So again, a civilian has a right to say, you know, show me your badge. You say you're a cop, show me your badge. And the officer is supposed to do so, but whether or not it happens is a different matter and can oftentimes lead to escalation.
So we've gotten through what stop and frisk is, what it is in New York, what it is in other cities. And I know you're one of the lawyers on a long-running set of litigation that the Center for Constitutional Rights has brought against the New York City Police Department, starting with the killing of Amadou Diallo in 1999 in the first case, Daniels v. New York, which then gave you a statistical basis for beginning to look at stop and frisks because the court ordered statistics be kept on stop and frisks. So what's the current case? It's called Floyd, and what have the statistics shown? And then let's talk about the litigation.
Okay, well, the statistics that we've been looking at really since 2003 have shown, first of all, an explosion of stop and frisk in New York City. I mean, it's become an epidemic. In the Bloomberg-Kelly era, you know, which is now we're in, I think, entering, what, year 11 of their administration, stop and frisk has increased over 600% in New York City. The first year of their administration, 2002, we had about 90,000 stops by officers. Last year, we were approaching 700,000. And this is in an era of really flat, you know, crime rates. It's not as if we've had, you know, a huge increase in crime in the city, which may, I mean, I'm not saying it would, but maybe that would be an argument for more aggressive policing. But we've seen crime either go down or be flat for those 10 years, and yet the stop and frisk has exploded. We've seen just very disturbing racial disparities in who is being stopped. You know, it's almost 90% of the stops are of Black and Latino New Yorkers, and this is true across the city. If you go to a, you know, a majority minority neighborhood, if you go to a racially mixed neighborhood, it's Blacks and Latinos that are the ones being stopped almost 9 out of 10 times.
And the city's 52% Black and Latino. You're saying the stops are something like 90%.
Yes, and then the other piece which I alluded to earlier is that the rate of return, so to speak, on these stops is almost non-existent. I mean, they found 800 guns last year, which, you know, may sound like, oh, that's a big number, 800 guns. But when you consider it was almost 700,000 stops that it took to get those 800 guns, you know, and that in a single weekend, the police can get that much in a gun buyback program, really, I think, begs the question, are these stops necessary?
Darius, talk a bit, if you will, about Comstat and the effect that has had on these figures.
Well, I think it's had a very direct effect. You know, Comstat was a program that was created under Giuliani and Bill Bratton, his first police commissioner. And the idea behind it was to use data to really make decisions about, you know, where to devote police resources. And in some ways, it was a good idea because, you know, they'd look at crime rates around the city and decide, okay, well, we look like we have a lot of crime in this neighborhood, so we need more officers over here. But what it's turned into is it's turned into a numbers game that is really being used to measure officer performance and, you know, the quality of a police officer's work solely by how many stops or arrests or tickets they write. And that's really caused, I think, a perverse incentive for officers to just do these things, stop people, you know, frisk them, shake them down so that they can get a promotion. You know, whether or not the arrest was justified or the stop was justified is pretty much beside the fact for them. They just want to get their numbers up. And it's caused, I think it's definitely contributed to this explosion.
Now, does financial incentive factor into any of this? In other words, are there grants, be it from Homeland Security or other places, that would make more stop and frisks something the administration wants to engage in?
You know, they would never admit that, but I think that may be what's going on here because, you know, they do get a lot of federal money that they have to show they're using to, you know, bring down gun violence or, you know, address drug use. And so, I mean, again, it's a very easily quantifiable way to do that is to say, well, look how many drug arrests we made last month. And I think you guys all know about the explosion of the marijuana arrests in the city, you know, over the past 10 years, or actually 15 or 20 years, you know, that New York Police Department's arresting something like 50,000 people a year for essentially just possession of small amounts of marijuana, which in many cases is not even a crime. It's a violation. I think, you know, that small amounts of marijuana possession was decriminalized in New York State in the 70s.
Does a lot of that happen from stop and frisks?
Absolutely. You know, because again, you look at the demographics of who's arrested for these offenses, it's overwhelmingly young Black and Latino men. And we all know that when you talk about marijuana marijuana use in New York or nationally that, you know, white folks use it as much, if not more, than blacks and Latinos. Yet these arrests are mostly of black and Latino young men, and that's because they most often happen as part of a stop and frisk.
Let's go to two areas on this. One mm-hmm. is the lawsuit and then the community activism on this. So the lawsuit was filed
2008, and last week we were given a trial date in the case of March 18th, 2013. So to everyone out there who's interested in this issue, we encourage you to keep close tabs on this because the New York Police Department's stop and frisk practices are literally going to be put on trial in a federal court in Manhattan this coming spring.
Now, you're looking for people to call in or to talk about that with you? Or?
Well, we have a website set up because, you know, we were certified as a class action in May by the judge in our case. And so we have a website for class members. So folks who believe they have been illegally stopped and frisked over the past 7 years since 2005 could be members of this class. And if you think you are one of those people, you can go to www.stopandfrisklawsuit.com and you can fill out an online questionnaire, which will be completely confidential. Only the lawyers in the case will see it, describing your experiences and letting us know whether you're interested in possibly being a trial witness or getting involved in the advocacy around this issue.
Now, what are you asking for in the lawsuit? What kind of result can you get? I mean, how do you really stop 700,000 stop and frisks? Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. And what can you do about it?
Well, I think the number one thing that, you know, we've learned the hard way over the past decade and or so doing this work is that we cannot leave it to the New York Police Department to fix the problem on their own. In other words, they cannot police themselves. There's going to have to be independent and outside oversight of this police department for, I would say, several years to ensure that they make real changes, to ensure that they are, you know, training and supervising their officers to respect people's rights. And we don't think they're going to be able to do that on their own. They've shown over the past 10 years that they can't do it on their own or they're unwilling to. So, you know, whether that's a federal court monitor, whether it's somebody from the state attorney general's office or the federal department of justice, there has to be independent oversight of the police department. And that's the primary thing. And in terms of other changes, you know, I think what we are going to try to do over the next several months is really not only get input from, you know, kind of the experts in this field around the country, but to get input from the communities that are most affected by this practice in New York to find out, you know, what do you think would help the situation, would help you feel safer when you're around the police, to trust the police? What do you need for the police department to understand about your neighborhood to make sure that they're doing things effectively and legally?
I find it interesting that in addition to the need for oversight, mm-hmm. There is no requirement currently that NYPD identify themselves to the public. Mm-hmm. So for those officers that are wearing the badge on mm-hmm. their neck that's not visible, isn't there also a public safety argument that I would think officers mm-hmm. would want that because there have been so many friendly fire instances?
No, you would think. I've heard the detectives and the other undercovers say, well, you know, we need to be kind of inconspicuous to do our jobs. But I guess, you know, to your point, once they are interacting with somebody, once they're in a tense situation, it seems to me that if they identify they're an officer, it may actually help diffuse the situation, you know, because if somebody comes up to me and puts their hands on me and I'm like, who the heck are you? And I get angry, if they tell me they're a police officer, that may, you know, at least, okay, so I see you're doing this not because you're just trying to be a jerk, or at least, you know, I hope you're not doing it to be a jerk. You're doing it because you're trying to fight crime. It may de-escalate. So I agree with you. And I think that goes into the other point that I think Michael was wanting to talk about, which is some of the other activism around this issue. There's currently a series of bills that's been introduced in the New York City Council called the Community Safety Act, which is a series of bills to address a lot of these problems. And one of those pieces of legislation would make it, you know, city law that a police officer, whenever they stop you, is going to have to volunteer that they are a police officer and show their badge and identify themselves.
And, of course, there's a community group out there. Mm-hmm. What's it called that you guys work with?
The Communities United for Police Reform. We have the acronym CPR. And we also have a website, which is www.changethenypd.org, where you can find out information about some of the other activities we're involved in. You know, there's legislative advocacy. There's Know Your Rights trainings, Cop Watch trainings, which I'm a big fan of, and other stuff that we're involved in.
Darius, many months ago we interviewed several students who participated in Know Your Rights trainings, and I think as we talk about this statistically, it's one thing, but when you look at the human impact that it has on young children who are brought up to expect that as they're leaving school or walking down the streets, this is a daily part of their life. I just can't imagine the sort of psychological toll this takes in their maturation process and how it affects their daily lives.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the real tragedies of this whole policy and this practice of the police department is it's really causing, you know, young people and people in communities that I think really need the police's help, it's causing them to just be very afraid and distrustful of the police and you know, for good reason, you know, and to view the police as an occupying force, to view them as not there to protect them, but there to actually oppress them. I think that's one of the things that the police department is really doing itself a disservice and making its own job harder, because in order to fight crime, I mean, any policing expert will tell you that you need the, you know, you need to work together with the community. And if the community doesn't trust you, if they fear you, that's not going to happen. And I think the police department's really, you know, shooting itself in the foot by doing this practice, because it's alienating large, you know, swaths of communities in this city that really, I think, have a lot to contribute to the crime fighting efforts, but they don't want to go to the police.
Now, the center has documented some of that. And,
yes.
And there's a publication that people can get online or sent to them?
Yes.
It's quite good on this, I think.
It's called Stop and Frisk, The Human Impact, The Stories Behind the Numbers, The Effects on Our Communities. And it's a report that we put out in July, which you can get on our website, www.ccrjustice.org, and it you know, it contains a series of interviews with folks from all over the city from different backgrounds about their experiences with Stop and Frisk, and also their attitudes about the police, which I think are very much affected by their experiences with Stop and Frisk.
I want to spread this out a little bit, and of course the basic Stop and Frisk law applies across the country. And look at some of the other places where this has been a problem. Philadelphia, for example, they've dealt with it a bit differently, but talk a little about Philadelphia and then why you see it being different in some cities versus others.
Well, Philadelphia was sued as well in 2010, and their mayor and police commissioner's response was completely 180 degrees different from New York. I mean, within, I think, 6 months, they had reached an agreement with the plaintiffs to make a lot of very I think significant changes to their stop and frisk practices, how they document, how they monitor, you know, the way they're going to train their officers on this stuff, and are really working together with the community to not only address, you know, the problems, but to really figure out how they can both, you know, protect the public and keep the city safe as well as respect people's rights. You know, contrast that to New York, where we're now going on, you know, 13 years fighting this fight and the city won't even admit that they've done anything wrong. It's a completely different situation. Outside of New York and Philadelphia, you know, a lot of other cities that we've looked at, they just don't use stop and frisk as much as New York does. And I think there's a, you know, a couple reasons for that. One being, of course, that New York is much more of a walking city, so it's, you know, a lot more pedestrians. So, you know, other cities maybe use traffic stops a little bit more than stop and frisk. But
yeah, on the New Jersey Turnpike, for example, we had for years and still do, driving while black.
Absolutely.
As being a crime.
Yeah, in Maryland as well. And then also, you know, in Los Angeles, they were sued in the end of the Clinton administration by the Justice Department for, you know, racially discriminatory traffic stops. But, you know, another piece of it, I think, is that, you know, again, going back to Comstat and the broken windows policing philosophy, New York was the pioneer of that and I think continues to be the most aggressive user of that philosophy, and I think that translates into all these stops. You know, I think what the NYPD apologists refer to it as proactive policing. You know, in other words, we're going to intervene before there's, you know, anything wrong has happened. But of course, you really, it's a really slippery slope, because, you know, if nothing wrong has happened, if someone's not doing anything wrong, what basis does an officer have to interfere with their liberty? So, you know, I think that's another piece of this, is that New York, you know, the policing philosophy here is very much in favor of aggressive tactics like stop and frisk.
Something just to add as we wind up that relates to that is that many cities are using technology such as ShotSpotter, predictive analytic devices. Does New York have many of those? It doesn't seem as though we do.
I'm not sure. I haven't really heard of that being used at that
what
much
shot
here.
Spotter?
I don't know. It's a triangulation device that detects when a shot has been fired and transmits it immediately to the police department.
No. I mean, I think here they still rely on the kind of old school, you know, we got a call that shots were fired in this neighborhood, or, you know, which, you know, I'm not saying they shouldn't be doing that, but it seems to me that if they're going to promote themselves as the most technologically advanced police force in the world, and they're not even using some of these more innovative technologies, it's a little ironic, I guess.
Well, Darius, it's been a pleasure as usual to have you on, and this is such an important case for all New Yorkers.
And tell us once more where people can go for more information to help out with the case, etc.
StopAndFriskLawsuit.com, and then we have the website for the Communities United for Police Reform, which is www.changethenypd.org.
Great. Well, thank you, Darius. Good luck. March 2013, right?
We look forward to it.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.